Morning, everyone. We'll call the conference committee for the Senate and the House Agriculture Rural Economies committees to order. Welcome, everyone. Hope you had a great weekend. We're not in the fields yet down in southwest Minnesota, but you guys up north are too wet for us. I'd like to start out. We'll just start out going around the room introducing everyone so we know who everyone is at the table. And we'll start with Libby at the end.
Mr. Governor.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Libby Krieger, and I work for Senator Magnus. I'm his LA.
Jeremy Miller, State Senator from District 31, Winona, Fillmore, Houston counties.
I'm Sean Nano. I live in the Cambridge area. I represent Isanti County and Chisago County, roughly.
I'm Gary Dames. Redwood. I live in Redwood Falls, Minnesota. Represent Lyon, Redwood, Brown, and part of Watonwan County. Senate District 21.
Gary Kubley. I'm Senator Dames' neighbor. Along with six other senators, I represent Renville, Chippewa, Swift, Big Stone, Lackawanna, Yellow Medicine, and Lincoln counties, seven entire counties, and I have to gain more people than any other senator.
Stephanie James, Senate counsel for the Ag Committee.
Dan Mueller, fiscal analyst for the Ag Committee.
Greg Knopf, Senate analyst for the Ag Committee.
I'm Doug Magnus, state senator from the southwest part of the state. I represent the six counties in the southwest area.
Rod Hamilton, I represent District 22B, which is three of the six counties that Senator Magnus represents.
I'm Joan Harmon. I'm the committee administrator for the Ag Committee.
Mike Lemire, state representative, District 12B, representing Morrison and Crow Wing County.
Kent Eakin, District 2A, and that includes all of Norman County, all of Manoman County, most of Becker County, and the southern parts of Polk and Clearwater counties.
Ron Szymanski, our representative for District 18A, representing McLeod and a portion of Meeker County.
Hi, I'm State Rep Paul Anderson, all of Pope County, that's P-O-P-E, and about half of Stearns County and part of Candy, Ohio County.
Jim Reinholtz, House Fiscal Analyst.
Colby Sullivan, House Research.
Adam Kephart, GOP researcher.
Nancy Conley, DFL researcher.
Over here, Brad.
Brad Kusterman, GOP researcher.
Ryan Majerus,
Senator. And Western CLA for the Ag Committee.
Jennifer Plum, Committee Administrator of the Senate Agriculture Committee.
All right, thank you, everyone. Just to lay out our schedule here as we're planning it today is we'll meet till 10 or so this morning and then recess, come back in about 1 o'clock. We have this room all day. Hopefully we can get done with this bill today. Come back in at 1, we'll go until 3 when you folks need to go to the house again, and then if we need to, we'll come back and get it finished up. But we would like to finish the bill today if we can. The governor's anxious to see it and put a signature to it, and we're anxious for him to do that. We'll start out, I think, have Mr. Mueller we'll go through the does everyone have a spreadsheet? We'll start out with that and go through the spreadsheets. Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chairman and members, there should be just a one-page spreadsheet. It's a front and back. This one just summarizes the change items between the House and the Senate bills. The way it's structured, there's two Senate columns, fiscal year 12 and 13, Senate, you'll see over on the left. And then there's the Senate tails, fiscal years 14, 15, and then the House, fiscal years 12 and 13. Then you'll see a column in between the two big House columns called House minus Senate. And that's probably the one we should look at, and that shows the differences between the House and the Senate bill, and there's only a few. We both had the same general fund target within $1,000. And I'll highlight just the differences. The general fund target for both bills was $76.601 million, which was a 14% reduction. And the differences on line 22 and 23 The Senate picked up a late governor's recommendation to move money within the Department of Ag between the marketing division and the agency services division. That's $570,000. And that's just, it nets out to zero. So that's just moving money between divisions. So that's on lines 22 and 23. Line 25 is a house provision for ag in the classroom. And maybe we're going through the language later. We can talk more about what those programs are. We can probably take lines 26 through 29 all together. Those are all basically dealing with ethanol and the agri program. And we have the Senate does a couple things a little bit different than the House. The Senate has a first year reduction to the ethanol payments of $1.365 million. Or no, that's the House is $1.365 million. The Senate does a sort of reduction over 2 years of $12.82 million. The Senate then moves $3.5 million into the next-gen grant program in the first year. And then on line 28, the Senate appropriates $100,000 for the Lake of the Woods biomass grant. And then on line 29, when we have the money left over from the ethanol payments for the agri program, the Senate does a $12.542 million reduction. When you compare that to the House just does a reduction in ethanol programs, doesn't move any money to the next gen, but then has a smaller reduction to the agri program. So the House leaves more money in the agri program. When you take it all together, it's about a $379,000 difference, all those change items lumped together, of what the House and Senate does with ethanol and agri program. Line 30, the House has a House-only provision, $100,000 for the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and that carries over into the tails. So overall general fund difference between the House and the Senate, you'll see on line 32, is $279,000 for the Department of Ag, when you take into account all those different change items. The next difference between the House and the Senate is within the Ag Fund on line 36. The Senate has the anhydrous ammonia inspection, the increased spending, and the increased fee that was in the governor's bill. The House does not. So then the next change you'll see on revenues down on line 55, which ties to the anhydrous ammonia inspection. The Senate carries the fee increase on line 55, and the House does not. Next, on to the Animal Health Board. The House and the Senate are exactly the same, the $255,000 per year general fund reduction, and that was in line with the governor's proposal. On the backside, we have the AURI. The Senate has a 5% reduction, $140,000 per year, general fund reduction. The governor had no reduction, and the House had no reduction to this area. So you'll see on lines 84 and then down to 87, the net general fund cut or reduction in this area. Again, where the House and the Senate are essentially the same target, $760,000 general fund, House is at 7601, so $1,000 difference. We have the same revenue changes, so the same overall target reduction, which is a 14% of a $12.555 basically $1,000 reduction to the base. And that's it. Those are the only differences between the House and Senate bill.
Okay, any questions on the spreadsheet? All right, All right, we'll go into the side-by-side next, and you all should have that in your packets. Mr. Knopf, would you lead us through the side-by-side, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. You look on the first page, you get the boilerplate language of the summary of appropriations, and then the language that tells how the appropriations are treated at the bottom of page R1. Over in R2, there's also not much. This is all just numbers and specifying appropriations. Again, we went through that on the spreadsheet. On page R3, you'll see we've got both sides have the same riders dealing with the voluntary cleanup program and the wolf and elk damage program. That language, as far as I can tell, is the same. And then, Mr. Chair, members, you get over to page R4, and we'll see some differences here in the riders. And the first rider in the top, if you look on R4 on the Senate side, that's on 3.9 to 3.19, you'll see that included in the rider on 3.18 to 3.19 is recommendations for fee changes to eliminate the shortfall. On the House side, on 3.9 to 3.10, this is a one-time appropriation, so the House funds the food handler, the increased food handlers, for the two-year period, and then it cuts off at the end. Also on 3.16, the House talks about the department's perceived shortfall of necessary inspection, whereas the Senate just says the shortfall in necessary inspections. The rider on the bottom of page R4, the one difference, this is the Senate has the kind of the base rider that we've been carrying for a while, but if you look on 3.33 to 3.34, it says identify and promote, whereas on the House side, it just says promote. So that's a slight difference in the language of the rider. And then, Mr. Chair, the top rider on both the House and Senate for the training and technical assistance to counties and town officials is a base rider that we've been carrying. That's the same on both sides. Now the House has a different provision on 4.1 to 4.13 dealing with sustainable agriculture that allows them to spend up to $100,000 each year. As I understand it, there was no money in the spreadsheet for this, but this allows for that. And then, Mr. Chair and members, if you look on page R6, the first rider on the cost share for organic farmers, that's the same. That's a base rider on both sides. And then the House has a provision on ag in the classroom. Mr. Mueller mentioned this going through the spreadsheet, the money for that. And so that's where the rider is in the House side of 5.24 to 5.31. And then, Mr. Chair, I don't know if the House want to explain anything as we're going through. I just point those out as we go through. And then, Mr. Chair, on page R7, we've got some differences here. The top rider is both sides dealing with the ethanol payments for this final year. In fact, the House actually, you can see that on 5.34, they actually include the word final. And then on 6.1, they have in either year, but this is only 1 year, so I think that's just a typo. The Senate also carries a provision on 5.17 to 5.21 dealing with a pro rata basis if there's not enough money. Apparently, this is going to be enough money, so we really don't even need that sentence on 5.17 to 5.21 on the Senate side. Another difference is that the Senate makes this money available until spent. With the House program, any money that would go to the agri program would be only available in the first year, any money that would fall to the bottom line. The House has a provision dealing with the funding base. The Senate deals with it later because we actually have an appropriation for the agri program. The House does not have a rider for the agri program. And then on 5.29 through the end of that, through the end of the page and on to the next page, the Senate has a provision for the Next Gen Energy Board. It's $3.5 million for bioenergy grants. And this is similar language to what the House and Senate passed in 2007 for Next Gen grants. And so that's included here. The House does not have a similar provision. And that's using some of the ethanol money that would have otherwise gone to the agri program. And then Mr. Chairman, if we go over to page R8, you can see the continuation of the rider for the next gen going through 6.36 in the Senate. And then on 7.1 to 7.10, you have the agri program. And this, again, if you look at 7.9 to 7.10, we do the same thing the House does, only we put it in our rider for the agri program. But that's the money for the agri program. 7.11 to 7.14, I think Mr. Mueller, when going through the spreadsheet, there is a biomass, basically for site identification feasibility study in Lake of the Woods County. That was from Senate File 46, Senator Saxog. That's the $100,000 one-time appropriation for that in the first year. And then if you go, Mr. Chairman, and members to R9, this is a kind of a base rider in the Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program. The House has kind of embellished the language or elaborated on the language a little bit. If you look on 6.28 to 6.33, they've got a detailed accomplishment report, future plans, and anticipated accomplishments, which are added from what the Senate has. The other thing that the House does is the report on this has to also go to the ranking minority members and not just the chairs. And then so that's a difference between the House has got some additional language and they're dealing with the ranking minority members. On page R10, those riders are basically the same. These are base riders for grants to various organizations through the Commissioner of Agriculture. On R11, the top one is the Turf Seed Council. That was a combination of two riders from 2 years ago. Dealing with the Turf Seed Council. The one difference is that the House on 8.4 to 8.7 has the grant recipient must actively participate in AURI's Renewable Energy Roundtable. The Senate does not have that language. The bottom rider is another base rider dealing with Second Harvest Heartland, the food banks for milk distribution, and that's the same as, again, it's a base rider that we've had for a few years anyways. And Mr. Chairman, members, if you look on the top of page R12, the first one is just the end of the rider from the previous page. The next one is this is a base rider dealing with the Board of Trustees, dealing with the mental health counseling grants to Central Lakes College and Ridgewater College. The one difference is the House added the word on 9.6, added the word statewide. And Mr. Chairman, then the next one is the Horticultural Society. That's the same. Same with the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, or AFREC, grant money, the $800,000 per year. That's the same on both sides, that rider. And then the House, on the bottom, Mr. Mueller explained in the spreadsheet that the $100,000 for the Center for Rural Policy and Development, we understand that this works is in the second year, and then it would become part of the base after that. And then, Mr. Chairman, on the top of page R13, the House also has a provision that allows the Commissioner of Agriculture to allocate operating reductions to program operations throughout the agency, so the Commissioner could move money around between programs and to fund the operation support for the agency. And, Mr. Chairman, then you've got the appropriations of the Board of Animal Health and AUR. Nothing really to explain there. The Senate now has a Senate-only provision, Section 6. That's from Senate File 558, Senator Rosen, and this deals with burying concrete or reinforcing bar from a building or structure located in land use for farming. It would allow farmers to do that. And then if you see on the next page, it deals with recording of that. So it's required that an owner of land who buries those material must record it with the county recorder and an affidavit containing a legal description of the property. And then we also have a Senate only in Section 7. This is from Senate File 776, Senator Rosen. This is actually an amended provision from the original bill. Basically, it says that the commissioner has the sole regulatory authority over terrestrial application of pesticides, including application to crops, structures, and other non-aquatic environments. What this says is that unless, except for, except Subdivision 3 is where the actual ag could convey that authority to someone else or delegate it to someone else, But the important point here is that the only time that another agency besides agriculture can regulate terrestrial application would be if the target site includes the application to public waters of the state. On to Section 8 on the Senate, Set 6 on the House, those are the same dealing with that. That's the definition of ammonia and anhydrous ammonia. Section 9, the Certificate of Regulatory Compliance, is the same. These are from the governor's recommendations. And then then we get to Sections 10, 11, and 12 on the Senate side that are not on the House side. The governor's budget included the surcharge that Mr. Mueller mentioned on anhydrous ammonia. Ammonia and the Senate includes the 75 cent per ton surcharge and the $400 reinspection fee. And Section 10 just clarifies that that money would be placed in the fertilizer inspection account of the department. So all the money collected would be placed in that account for the department to spend on those activities. Section 13 on the Senate and 8 on the House are the same. Section 14 and that deals with compliance for the fertilizer and anhydrous ammonia. Section 14 is the same on both sides. The only change is on 1430 on the Senate on the non-agricultural pesticide, so that with agricultural pesticides they would pay the fee regardless of whether it was a hit the de minimis of $10 or not. And then on page R17 we have the account appropriation. That's that transfer of fund or funding source for the wholesale produce dealers from the general fund to the agricultural fund. And then Section 16 and 11 dealing with county agricultural societies, exchange of lands, that's from Senator Saxog and Senate File 260. And that's the same on both sides, that part of it. Then on the House side, on page R18, you have this on the oversight. Basically, it says a commissioner must allocate available funds as specified by the legislature. The Senate doesn't amend that provision, so the Agri program would work as it does today, where the commissioner could spend the money after consulting with the chairs and ranking minority members of the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over agricultural finance. Section 17, livestock mortalities, that's from Senate File 558, Senator Rosen, and that clarifies that the Board of Animal Health or the executive director is responsible for the regulation and oversight of livestock mortality disposal. Section 18 on the Senate and 13 on the House, you'll see on page R19, actually I think the changes go all the way to R20, and you'll see with the new language that the House and Senate are a little bit different. The House maintains the current language for the county highway right-of-way so that they don't have to go through the hearing process. And then also provides a separate process for the for when lands are exchanged that are not highway county highway right of way. The other difference is there's a sentence in the middle here on 1514 to 1516 in the House side where it says the private appraised value of the parcels must be substantially equal to the county assessor's estimated market value of similar land as adjusted by the sales ratio determined by the Commissioner of Revenue. So that's a little bit, that's an added restriction on the private appraisal that's in the House side but not in the Senate side. Otherwise, the public hearing and other requirements are the same, other notice requirements. And then, Mr. Chairman, if we can go all the way to R21, the last page. The Senate is carrying a Clean Water Fund extension of appropriations from 2009. That was in the governor's budget. The House does not have that in this bill. And then also the House has a repealer of the ethanol program on June 30th, 2012. Should say the ethanol producer payment program. And Mr. Chairman, that's the end of the explanation of the side-by-side.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Knopf. Any questions on the side-by-side at this time? Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Senate language for the Next Gen Energy Board, The way the current language sits here today, can the commissioner already fund that without this language being added? Or is this necessary to make sure that NextGen is fully funded?
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the full AGRI statute out in front of me, but if I recall, that does allow for funding through NextGen. But then, so it wouldn't be totally necessary to have this, although this kind of provides the boundaries for the program, whereas that would be fairly open as to how it would work.
Thank you.
Mr.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chairman, I should.
Well, yeah.
I should point out that it gets it out in the first year, too. I mean, it gets $3.5 million out in the first year.
Yeah, there's 2 points, Representative Hamilton. It's we specify the amount that goes to the NextGen board. If we don't, then it's basically up to the commissioner's discretion what he wants to put in. And the second part of it is that we get the money in there the first year so the board can meet and put out the grants the first year. Otherwise, it's not specified in there the first year.
Thank you.
So I think the way the language would work, if we did not specify this, the money would, whatever ethanol payments are not made up to the maximum here, would all go into the AGRI fund. And then the commissioner would have the discretion, basically, with consulting of us, depending on what language we take regarding that. But the way the statute is now, it's up to the commissioner could put the money wherever he wants to. Any other questions? If not, I think we'll go ahead and start take public testimony. Unless we want to act on amendments first. Why don't we go ahead and take some public testimony now? Whoever wants to testify, step up, Mr. Solosinski.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Paul Solosinski. I'm a livestock and grain farmer from Wabasso, Minnesota, and I work for the Land Stewardship Project. We support more farmers on the land raising crops and livestock. Three key programs in the Land Stewardship Project are the Policy and Organizing Program, a program for farm beginnings, and a program that supports local foods. I'm here to support the demonstration grant program of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. In 2009, in the last ag budget cycle, this program was cut from $160,000 to $100,000 a year, over a 60% cut, when the Hall Department of Ag budget was cut about 8%. We would ask that you fund this program at a minimum of $100,000 per year for the next 2 years. These grants and the Green Book, which I'm sure that you have copies or the department will make available, are very important parts of the program. They showcase 281 creative and innovative grants that Minnesota farmers and researchers who have participated in this program over the last 21-year history. Grants like Fieldstone Vineyards at Morgan, Minnesota, Don Redding has turned into a very successful piece. Cover crops like Tony Thompson has done in the southwestern part of the state, and programs like extending the vegetable season, high tunnels, are all just parts of these programs. With that, I'd like to ask Carmen Fernholz, who has participated in one of these grants, to make some comments. His testimony is here for distribution, too. Thank you.
Senator Kubley.
Didn't we ask the testifiers and the people around the table refer to the page number? It would certainly help find the piece that's being addressed.
It's found on page R5, the demonstration grant program.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's an R5 house language beginning on line 4.1 through 4.13.
Okay. Mr. Fernholz.
Senator Magnus, Conference Committee, my name is Carmen Fernholz. I have a 450-acre diversified cropping system farm near Madison, Minnesota, and have been farming there since 1972. When it comes to research and development in any endeavor, leveraging dollars is a critical first factor, especially in today's economy. Agriculture is no exception, given the ever-tightening profit margins continually being driven by higher energy costs, stricter environmental concerns, and ever-growing global market competition. Therefore, I feel it is most important to give strong consideration to tried and true initiatives such as the MDA's Energy and Sustainable Agriculture Grant Program. I say this for several reasons. The first is the fact that I have been the recipient of three of these grants over the history of the program, with the latest being the most recent round of proposals. This program has been a major driver of sustainable farming innovations in the state since its beginning in the 1980s. It has served as an incubator for truly creative, sustainable innovations in agriculture. The innovations that have come out of this program have helped a broad cross-section of farmers, sustainable and conventional alike. The results of this research are reported in the internationally respected Green Book. This has marked Minnesota as a leader in researching and promoting innovative farming systems. Let me cite a specific example. In the most recent grant reward, I put forth a demonstration that uses alfalfa mulch as a major source for nitrogen fertility in a crop production system. After I had set up the research on my farm, I took the idea to the university and described it to them. They took hold of the basic concept and have developed it into a full-blown three-year study to begin this year, this season, at several of the research sites. The results of this research can serve both conventional and organic systems equally in areas of reduced herbicide usage and lower energy-dependent fertilizer sources, while at the same time reducing overall production costs. And environmentally speaking, this idea can truly advance major soil conservation practices on many farms that today do not have livestock to utilize pasture and other cover crops across the landscape. In summary, what I am saying is that the Energy and Sustainable Agriculture Grant Program has created a very hostile-free environment that allows ideas to surface and take shape and rise or fall on their own merits, with the great potential of developing into impacting innovations across the agricultural landscape. $100,000 a year is a small amount to continue to invest in a multi-billion dollar food system that cannot afford to be static in today's global society's economy. It was this very amount of dollars in the 1980s that initially took the organic certification program across the threshold to evolve into the multi-billion dollar food production system it has become in Minnesota and across the country. The same thing continues to happen on an annual basis today when we examine the creative ideas being borne out by the demonstration grants. Capital investment in research and development is continuing to be harder and harder to come by. Why not engage and create a closer relationship between the researcher and the practitioner? Leveraging dollars for agriculture research is, in my opinion, the ultimate goal for this grant program. And I thank you. Are there any questions?
Any questions for either Mr. Fernholz or Mr. Sobosinski this time? Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony today. I was just, you mentioned leveraging dollars as well, and I was just wondering if you've got any figures as to how much is being leveraged with the dollars that have been allocated in the past through this grant program.
Mr. Sobosinski or Mr. Fernholz?
Carmen?
Mr. Chairman, committee, I don't have the figures on leveraging, but I think where we come from is when we look at a lot of the cost share, and what I'm saying is the amount of time that I, as a participant in these grant programs, use without compensation beyond what the grant gives. I use my equipment, I use my land, I spend a lot of time going out and talking to people about what has gone on that farm. Certainly some of it is compensated, but a lot of it is in kind that I give of myself.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Fernholz. And that's the point I just wanted to make. I guess I think we do want to be funding programs, obviously, that do leverage that type of funding and that type of volunteerism, I guess, on the part of those that are participating. So thank you very much.
Okay, any further questions? If not, thank you, gentlemen. I think Senator Saxhog has indicated he wants to testify on the bill but has to leave shortly. So, Senator Saxhog, I'd like to have you come up and talk at this time, and we'll come back to the green book and others. I'll pass this green book around so folks can take a look at it and see what's in it. Good morning, Senator Saxhog. I know you've got a couple of provisions in the bill.
Well, thank you, Chairman Magnus, members of the conference committee. As Mr. Knopf said, Section 18 is the same as Senate File 260, which was my bill. And what I'd like to do this morning is offer an A5 delete all amendment in hopes that it may smooth some things out that maybe there was some disagreement on. And I'd like to ask Mr. Knopf to explain that A5 amendment. If somebody from...
Senator Miller, would you offer
I'll move the A5 amendment.
Okay. Senator Miller will move the A5 amendment. And Senator Saxhog, this is an agreement you and I have had. We did get some clarification from your folks back there on how they the best they view to proceed on this. So, Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you look on page 2 of the amendment, that's where the appropriate language is, and it would replace what's on R20 of the side-by-side. And what it would do is, it similar to the House, it would leave the county highway right-of-way exchange provision as is and just leave that alone. And it would create this new one for non-highway purposes. It would create have a new paragraph. That would basically have the same language that's in both sides, including the hearing, the public hearing, the notice of the hearing, and all of that was in both sides. The one thing it does not do, it does not include the extra sentence I mentioned on the private appraisal. A private appraised value of parcels must be substantially equal to the county assessors. It does not include that sentence, but otherwise it's similar to what the House is doing, only instead of breaking it into clauses. What it does is it just creates a whole new paragraph for this. I think it's a clearer way to read it, and keeps the county right-of-way exchange the same as it is under current law.
So what we're suggesting here then is to delete both of the languages and replace it with this amendment if we approve it?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. So we'd delete the languages. If we approve the amendment, members, we would delete the language on page 20 dealing with that, page R20 dealing with that, and replace it with this language. So any further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Senator, thank you. My question would be, we heard this in the House with Representative McElfatrick, and I believe she represents a portion of your district as well. My question would be, have you visited with Representative McElfatrick? And does this accomplish what it is that you and her are trying to accomplish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, yeah, I believe it does. She and I were substantially in agreement, completely in agreement on this particular So I think that she believes that putting this in and making it so that all of us agree on it would be a good thing to do.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Hamilton. All right. Any further discussion on the A5 amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. All right, we'll substitute the language on R20, delete both the Senate and the House, and put in the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Chairman Magnus, members of the conference committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Saxog. You started us out on the right track. We'll just keep rolling right along here. I think at this time, going back to the sustainable, I'd like to have the department come up and talk to us a little bit about what they perceive the language to be here on R5. I know we have language in here on the House side. The Senate, we did not talk about it, did not have a project or anything up there. It is not. This language is not in the base funding for the department at this time. So this would be additional language and adding it to the base if we decide to do that. I know on R5 that it says up to $100,000 a year. We attest to fires asking for $100,000 each year. The question I have from the department is that what does up to $100,000 mean to you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm Government Relations Director of the Department of Agriculture. Thank you for having us up to discuss this very important program. There are two aspects to the way this was portrayed in the governor's budget and is portrayed in the House language. The permissive language, which you see before you on page R5, lines 4.1 through 4.13, that language was in the governor's recommendation made to the legislature. What was not in the governor's recommendation was a specific line item in spreadsheet, as I understand it. So the permissive language allows us to have a placeholder for this program in the event that we have better economic times ahead as a state and that there is a supplemental budget next year. But at this point, we have the permissive language here. And I have Mr. Ernest, our Director of Finance, to discuss this, and also Mary Hanks, who's our Marketing and Development Director and also oversees the Sustainable Development Demonstration Grants, for more specifics.
Go ahead, ma'am. Please identify yourself and for the tape and...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Hanks. I'm the acting director of the Agricultural Marketing and Development Division. We just merged, so I'm still getting used to the new title. It's my understanding with this rider that this allows us to spend up to $100,000 should it be available even this year or this coming fiscal year or the next. It doesn't allocate dollars to this per se.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Steve Ernest, thank you. Finance Director at the Department of Agriculture. I would just point out that the key part of the language is the granting authority. The agency doesn't have blanket authority to grant money, so we do need that specifically if there's any reason we would identify for shifting current funds or ever having future funds to do this kind of work.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we talked about this or discussed this in committee, and I'm going to ask Mr. Reinholtz to say a few words on this as well, this is a placeholder. It did not allocate money. You won't see it on the spreadsheet. But if Mr. Reinholtz could just comment on that, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, the department did explain that well. Yeah, it is just granting them the authority to do grants here. The up to $100,000 is a little unusual language. It's really not an appropriation. Does not say is appropriated. It gives them authority. It is not an increase in base funding, like most riders are. This allows them to either use funds they receive from somewhere other than state general fund, or if they wanted to, they could reallocate some of their state general fund dollars within this program for that purpose.
Well, Mr. Reinholtz, how do you mean reallocate? Where would the money come from, for example?
Mr. Chairman,
if they chose to reallocate some of their money.
Mr. Chairman, state agencies have authority in statute to move funds that are appropriated within a program with certain restrictions. They always have that authority. They have to notify the legislature when they're doing it, but they do have that authority to move appropriations within programs. They have a base amount in this program, $3.6 million in the House version, $2.9 million in the Senate, and very little of that is actually directed within riders to particular uses. So they do have authority to move dollars around. They also have authority, for example, to accept gifts, or in this case, it could. I'm not sure if there's available federal grant money, and now then this would give them the authority to actually make the grants.
So, Mr. Reinholtz, if they got some federal grant money, they could, for these sorts of projects, they could go ahead and do that then?
Mr. Chairman, yes. As you heard the finance director for Ag say, they do not have blanket authority to make grants, but by giving them this authority and this rider, they have.
To make grants. I don't understand that. Okay. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ernest, you say that they don't have authority for making the grants, but if you look at the statute that this program is under, it says that it's filled with commissioner making grants for this purpose. And I don't quite understand why you need authority in law to make grants when you already have the authority to establish a grant program in the statutes. Could you help me with that?
Mr. Ernst?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the fact that a grant program exists, it needs an appropriation or an amount of money with the authority to be used for that program in order to exercise the program. Our budget is for operations of the agency, and so I think our interpretation is we would ask for the specific authority in order to use part of our operating budget to grant out.
And Mr. Ernst, how would you do that?
Mr. Chairman,
this language,
with this
you,
language.
Would you report to the chairs and ranking members before you move some money around? I guess my confusion is, okay, you've got this money sitting here, And how do you do that? I mean, do you report to us before you do it, or just tell us at the end of the year we spent this money on this and this and this, or how does that work, Mr.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's a function of the accounting system, the allotments and encumbrances. When we give you the budget, we have that in BBS, all broken down by how we intend to spend it. When we translate that into the accounting system, there's a statute that requires us to do a spending plan to say what allotments we would put all the money into and what we plan to use it for. That within, as Mr. Reinholdt said, within the law can be adjusted from time to time within the appropriation limits and across programs if it's for the same purpose, if it's just a who reports to whom change, but it's the same activity. So and we could always do extra reporting, but that information is in the accounting system at any time for you to request from the Department of Management and Budget or us.
Any further questions? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Would this language also give you a ceiling as to how much you could grant under this program, up to $100,000, no more.
Mr. Ernst?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this would be the ceiling for the program, and then the program has individual limits within its own language, its statutory language.
Okay. All right. No further questions. Anyone else wish to testify on the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
To the conference committee. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. My name's Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we also strongly support trying to add some of this language regarding the sustainable agricultural demonstration grants. Our members have found these grants very helpful for the past 20 years. Now, some of you know that there's a lot of different things when you're trying to think of doing something different on your farm. You have to deal with the bank and the FSA, and you're worried about losing base acres, and you want to try something a little different. And so sometimes a grant like this does help that idea and helps you go forward. I'll give you a quick example of I just saw the idea for these grants in Senator Nino's district, where we have a Avercat that's a biodiesel plant, and some of the farmers there want to plant camelina or pennycress. It's a different type as a cover crop, and they're not sure how that would work, and there's a lot of different things involved in it. And so a lot of times there's ideas like that that they want to try with a sustainable grant. Not that they'd get a grant for that or not, but it's a possibility, and it's something those farmers are thinking about. One other important thing that goes with the grant, too, is we talk a lot about the Green Book, but a lot of times the farmers find good help in the field days that usually accompany the grant. So when they are doing a lot of the different things that Mr. Fernholz mentioned, then they'll have a field day with it, where other farmers who are thinking about doing that same thing can come and ask questions of that person, and it's very helpful. And finally, I'd mention that in the past, the Department of Ag, to my knowledge, has used some federal dollars in helping enhance the Green Book through, I think they're called SARE grants, or Sustainable Agricultural Research grants that have come, and they have a similar type of thing, and they've added it to the Green Book and enhanced that in some years. So there is a precedent for that. So thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Do you like the rest of the bill, Mr. Peterson? Are you going to testify on the rest of the bill?
No, Mr. Chairman. Only other piece I'd add is we support the provision for the ag in the classroom teachers. I think is a really good, would get a lot of bang for the buck. So otherwise, we support the bill. Thank you. All
right. Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. Any questions?
Well, yes,
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does seem to me that our job as a government entity is to make information available on all styles of production so that the producer can choose what fits their style best. And a lot of this kind of research is actually on-farm research, as Mr. Fernholz pointed out, and it starts there. I was pleased to hear that the research stations are picking up on the research that he did, but it does seem to me that most of it starts on a local farm with somebody that wants to try a little different approach.
Okay. Anyone else care to testify at this time? Mr. Kadelka, how are you this morning?
Very good.
Good. Please identify yourself, Kurt, for the tape, and tell us what are your thoughts this morning from the Pollution Control Agency.
Good morning, Chairman and committee members. My name is Kurt Kadelka. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the bill and some of our concerns with three of the provisions in it. I think what I'll do, if it works for the chairman, is just to go as they appear in the bill, starting on page R13. Section 6 in the Senate bill dealing with concrete disposal. As we testified in the Senate Aid Committee, there are two concerns with this language. One, as we find out when that hole is dug for concrete to be buried on one's property, a lot of other things end up going down the hole, other building materials that may have a problem, paint, and whatnot. As we mentioned earlier in an earlier hearing, the PCA has been working with the county and reviewing other ways to handle the issue, because we know that there probably is a better way than the current system to do this. If this was enacted as the language is here, we would likely have to rely on a guidance document with best management practices. The second concern deals with a timetable on recording the burial of the materials. Our concern is that it allows for such a long time after the actual hole is covered up, and we tend to find that if it isn't done soon afterwards, it's forgotten about and never recorded. And how this comes back to the PCA is a number of times we're called in when a landowner, farmer, residential ends up doing some excavation on their own property. They find solid waste that's been buried. We're called in to do the investigation of that waste, and unfortunately that liability does string back to the previous owner. Our concern is, in the case of farms, is if this is done while the farmer is in their 30s or 40s, put there but never put on the deed, and isn't done until the actual property transfers, say when they retire from farming or whatnot 50 years later, or someone else, they move off the land and it's forgotten about. The next property owner then is on the land, does some excavating, finds the solid waste there, we're called in, and in that case, we would have to go after investigate the situation, and there may be recourse against the previous landowner. We just believe it's a good neighbor policy is if it's done as soon as possible after the hole is cleaned up. And we would defer to the county recorders on probably the best on that timetable and the manner to do it. The second issue is also on page R.
Delka, do you have any language to suggest in here then, or in the provisions here we have in the Senate language?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think we would defer to the counties on any date on how quickly this needs to be done. The county recorders are the experts on making these transactions on the deeds.
Okay.
On R14, Section 7 of the Senate bill, this deals with pesticides. Just a little background on this. There was a court case that had directed the EPA to create four types of permits because pesticides that were applied over waters were deemed to be a point source and then had to fall under the NPDES permit system. As a result, the state has been putting together general permits for four different examples under that situation. The language here from the earlier bill, we do appreciate the clarification of the terrestrial application of pesticides. It's much cleaner language, and we appreciate that. And we also agree on that first change sentence that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture should exclusively regulate the terrestrial application of these pieces. However, it's that last sentence where we have very strong concerns in the use of the words public waters versus waters of the state. Currently, the MPCA is charged by the legislature and state law to protect waters of the state. It's how our entire water quality protection regulating system is built off of. Our fear is that once we start punching a hole in that regulatory system, the hole will just get larger and create much larger problems for us down the road with the Clean Water Act and the EPA. There's also some concern that using public waters definition wouldn't be consistent with the court and EPA's direction. Unfortunately, public waters does not necessarily fit all the definitions of waters of the U.S. do not fit necessarily in public waters. There are select few that would not. Our concern is if someone really didn't like the way we were doing this permit, this would be one avenue for a lawsuit.
Maybe we could get a definition of between the public waters and waters of the state, just so the conference committee knows this. Whether Mr. Sullivan or Mr. Knopf, do you have any suggestions on the way we go here?
Mr. Chair, when we had the hearing on this bill, one of the reasons it was changed to public waters was that there was concern by committee members that waters of the state included, it was very broad. I think the agency said that they wouldn't use it that broadly, but it is a very broad term. Public waters are defined. These are waters that you can find on a map through DNR. It includes wetlands up to 10 acres in rural parts of the state, and within the city limits, it's up to 2.5 acres or greater, and then 10 acres or more in rural areas of the state, and includes all of our lakes, streams, and what have you. And I'm not sure that navigable waters of the U.S. should all be included in public waters, because navigable waters are navigable, in fact, at the time of statehood, which is a difficult concept for states to deal with. But this should include all of those navigable waters, as far as I'm concerned, for the waters of the United States. But unless you know more about that, Mr. Gadelka.
Mr. Gadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, talking to some folks who've done work with public waters of the definition of waters of the state, there are some basins that don't fall underneath, larger basins that don't fall underneath the determination of a waters of, excuse me, fall under waters of state but do not fall under public waters. It is not a large number, but it is, there are ones that fall outside it.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Knopf,
anything over 10 acres should be included anywhere in public waters. I mean, the inventory, I mean, if you look at the definition of public waters, it includes even wetlands that are over 10 acres in size, or 10 acres or more in size.
Mr. Clevin, I think you testified, had significant testimony on this bill, and I don't believe the House got to hear that. So maybe you want to tell them your thoughts, Mr.
Sure, Clevin. Mr. Chairman, be happy to do that. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent a number of groups here, wheat growers, sugar beet growers, and others. I'm collectively speaking, I think, for a number of the other groups, agri-growth, soybean growers, the union, the bureau. They all support the Senate provision here. Whether you choose public waters or some other definition, the background on this is really kind of heading the agency off at the pass. We're concerned that down the road they will try to regulate the terrestrial application of herbicides. If you go back to the court case was about applying stuff into the water. That's why you get an MPDS permit, is to discharge things into the water. The court case he's referring to, as he mentioned, was designed for four use patterns. And the one I always like to use is mosquito control. If you're putting an insecticide to stop mosquitoes from developing, you put it into the water. If you're spraying Roundup on the soybeans, you're putting it on the dirt. And you'll notice in line of the bill, line 12.8, the application of pesticides, unless the target site is into the water. That's what you'd get the permit for. Now, in terms of the public waters, what Ms. Gadelka didn't tell you was the court case requires this for waters of the U.S. The agency's draft took that and made it broader, and they're going to put it for waters of the state. Now, what's the difference? Waters of the U.S. are navigable, and there may be some gray areas about that. I admit that. But that's the definition. A water of the state includes the puddle out in front of your yard after a two-inch rain. It's any water contained within the state border. So the definition is much broader. The original bill we brought, and Representative Anderson actually authored it in the House. We never heard it, but the original bill would have scoped that to simply say that it's waters of the U.S. is what the PCA's authority is for issuing these new permits. Now, a bunch of other states, and I didn't bring my list here today, but there's a bunch of other states that are going just waters of the U.S. Our agency has proposed to go waters of the state. So our original effort was to define that like other states are doing. And in talking to Mr. Knopf and some of the Senate members, as an alternative to that, public waters was one of the ideas that came up and was eventually adopted in the Senate Ag Committee as a way to try to get at that issue. That way, the little swamp out behind the barn isn't covered, but a public water would be. And, of course, there's a defined list maintained by the DNR, I believe, that would tell you what a public water is or isn't. Mr. Chairman, that's our view on this issue. We don't want them to be requiring permits for spraying on dirt.
Okay. Any other questions? Chairman Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Does the Department of Agriculture have a position on this?
Somebody has to get up. Hello, Ms. Gothier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gothier, Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hamilton. The department was involved in the discussions during the committee hearing on this bill, which was traveling as a separate piece of legislation. There are two sentences in the amended language, and we are completely fine with the first sentence. Reconfirms that the Department of Agriculture is indeed in charge of terrestrial application of pesticides in Minnesota. The second sentence, we understand that the PCA has some concerns with it, and mainly as a precedent. As a sister agency, we understand that that is a potential precedent. There is legislation moving through the United States Congress right now that would supersede all this. And my understanding is it passed the House of Representatives last week and is moving forward in the Senate, and the Senate Agriculture Chair is the author of that bill. So we have reason to hope that there will be some clarification from the federal level, but that probably won't come down before this legislature is completed its work this year. So, Mr. Chairman, I would say we would support that first sentence, but we think that that's just fine to leave that in there. It accomplishes the goal of reinforcing that the Department of Agriculture in the future is indeed the sole agency in charge of terrestrial application of pesticides. The second sentence, we do see the concerns there regarding precedent. I know the governor has been in discussion with our commissioner about these concerns and the PCA commissioner as well. So I guess our preference would be that that line be removed, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Chairman Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question back to either one of the departments, if language is being moved at the federal level that's protecting the water, is there a need to have additional language here in Minnesota that's more stringent? I'm hoping that, I guess what I'm looking for here as well, or is this language more stringent than what's moving at the federal level? That would be my question. My comment would be is I'm hoping that we're all going to have level heads to prevail, that some common sense is played in this as well. When a farmer's out there applying this to his ground, and like the testifier had said, we get a rainfall, and now all of a sudden the farmer's out of compliance or having to have a permit or whatever the case may be. And so I'm looking for, like I said, common heads to prevail and some common sense brought into this as well. So is there a need to have more stringent regulations in the federal, and are we trying to do that by changing public waters to waters of the state? That would be my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. That's a big question that people could spend many, many hours discussing. But what I'll do is I will turn to Mr. Buzicki from our Pesticide and Fertilizer Division, the director of that division, who has more detail on this than I do.
Mr. Buzicki?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Greg Buzicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Representative Hamilton, the permits, and I'll just cover this very broadly, and perhaps PCA wants to talk in more detail, but the current permits are for four distinct activities, and I'll read those four permits: mosquito and other flying insect pest control, forest canopy pest control, aquatic nuisance animal pest control, and vegetative pest and algae control. Those are the only things that are being regulated by this NPDES activity. Now, to do that, the Pollution Control Agency has developed these four permits, and they're quite extensive and complex. They're, of course, using the NPDES process and law to deal with something that historically has been covered by FIFRA and the Minnesota Pesticide Control Law. So but that's what they've been directed to do by the court case. In the Clean Water Act, there is an exemption
for agriculture. It's a little bit complex, and it uses archaic language, which I don't recall off the top of my head, but it basically says this does not apply to agriculture. So we are very much, we've been working cooperatively with the PCA in trying to help them devise a NPDES permit that deals with these, again, four permit areas. The previous testimony is correct. A number of states have gone to, about half the states that I'm aware of have gone to waters of the U.S. About half the states have gone to waters of the state, and there's a few that have done something else. So you should be aware of that. And I would like to think, as it comes to your common sense question, that when we regulate pesticides and we regulate the label is the law, that we do in the Department of Agriculture use common sense in doing that and providing a clear, a firm but fair regulatory system. We have been trying to work with PCA as they've been getting up to speed over these last couple of years to do the same. But I have to acknowledge that they've done a tremendous job, and it's a very difficult job to try to make this NPDES rule work in these, even in these four permits. The final comment that I would make is that the legislation that has passed the House, the United States House, and has moved on to the Senate, is designed basically to eliminate this intersection of the Clean Water Act and FIFRA, and allow FIFRA to actually be the presiding authority. So it does away with the Congress clarifies how pesticide regulation occurs and addresses the conflict that the courts have set up. So I hope I've answered parts of your question, or if you would like more detail, I'd be happy to do that, or perhaps PCA can talk about their permits in more detail. And certainly Mr. Clavin is well aware of some of these things, and if he has any difference of opinion, my statements, I'm sure he'll mention them.
Mr. Clavin, speak now, or we'll have the Pollution Control come back up. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kadelka, you want to continue on with your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, are you leaving the NPDES section? Because if you are, I'll sit back down.
I think we are.
I had one more piece.
Mr. Kadelka had another section, I believe he was.
I had one more piece of light to shed on this before we leave on the NPDES, if I could.
Yes, sir.
And that has to do with another piece that we've been moving through in the Environment Finance Bill. It's actually in the Senate side in Senator Engelbretson's. And it has to do with the fiscal note on this. So that members understand, as we were doing that original bill that Senator Rosen carried, it had to do partly with the fiscal note. Because when we saw the PCA expanding beyond what the federal court required, in other words, the federal court required waters of the U.S., in theory, there are going to be a lot more permits issued if you expand the program to waters of the state. Just by definition, there's going to be more of them. And one thing we discovered in this process was that there was no fiscal note associated with this new pesticide program. This was done during the summer, and the agency was able to issue these, and as Mr. Buzicki said, there are four of them, and we don't disagree with that, and that's what the court said. What we're trying to do is scope down the program, because they're going to put a lot of staff, we assume, into this part of the program. The other piece we were running had to do with federal feedlot conformity. There's another case on a different subject that deals with that. And we were told if we try to amend those rules and conform to the federal law as it relates to feedlots, well, then there's a fiscal note associated with that. So partly what we were trying to do was scope this down so that we could find money for the change that we've been trying to make on the feedlot side for 2 years. And that's what led to the original bill in terms of scoping it down to waters of the U.S., and that would follow the court case. It seems like sometimes they follow the federal court cases, and then some other times they don't, and that's what we seem to run into from time to time.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Mr. Schoenfeld, do you wish to jump in on this discussion here?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
Right.
My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with Minnesota Soybean Growers on this particular issue, and I guess there's just two things that kind of
I think, are relative to this. One is that, as Mr. Clevin had indicated, relative to the NPDSs for feedlots, remember that that was put in 1997 because the PCA at that time had come forth and said that the federal government was going to require it, and so we should get ahead of the ball game on it. That's kind of the same thing that initiated this bill, in the fact that when the rules were put together on the spraying over waters, that we saw, at least in the rules, a crack that potentially it could expand to terrestrial applications. And so a similar nature in terms of being beyond what the federal government was requiring. We've had the NPDS on feedlots since 1997. A year ago, through Representative Eakin's committee, we did pass a bill to reverse that. We did the same thing in the House Policy Environment Policy Committee in the Senate. We're trying again to do it this year, and there is a provision in the Environment Finance Bill that works on that. I guess what I'm trying to say to you is that be careful about potential expansions. You passed House File 1 that said that the PCA should not expand environmental permitting or its rules beyond what federal law required. That was a very significant piece of legislation, at least by all press releases that seemed to come out of the state capitol here. And so our concern is that there is an expansion beyond what the federal requirement is. And the federal requirement is waters of the United States. And we're concerned about that, and that's why this is a bit of preemptive to stop that, and it seems that the PCA has objection to that. The other thing that I want to just comment, since I'm up here, I also work with the Minnesota pork producers. And the comment was made about the concrete rebar provision, and that farmers might throw paint pails or something, I'm not sure what, into this hole that would be dug for concrete. I guess that's possible. I assume it's also possible right now. And we were concerned about the concrete and supportive of some changes there because the PCA, after many years of saying nothing about it, was coming forth and saying now that that was solid waste and we had to deal with it. Probably more like a lot of commercial sites would in some cases, where they were suggesting that the concrete from a pit, as an example, be ground up and put out on a driveway or something as concrete. And one thing I'd mention to you about this whole idea about burying concrete is that concrete is already in the ground, and it's been there for some time. So in terms of, you know, what might possibly be thrown into there, we're not encouraging anybody to do that, and that's not what the purpose of this bill is. But I would guarantee you in a lot of farms right now that people can go out and dig holes and throw stuff in, and probably they're not supposed to, but it probably happens as well. I don't know what to do about that unless we're going to have a lot of concrete rebar cops all over the country, but looking at holes. But we do support that provision. We also support another provision that may be discussed later, and if so, I'll respond to that too.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Chairman Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the PCA, to my common sense question, and hope that level heads prevail, when we're talking about your definition versus what our concerns are, I'd like you to address that a little bit. You heard the testifier that says, what if we get an inch rainfall or whatever the case may be, and all of a sudden you have some puddles out there. Is the PCA going to take a look at that, and all of a sudden you're in violation? I want you to comment on that. And the question was brought up about NPDS permits for livestock facilities. It has been proven, and also there was a federal case where livestock facilities that do not discharge don't need an NPDS permit. But yeah, here in the state of Minnesota, we do require that. One of my marching orders from the farmers that I represent has said, do not regulate us out of business.
And my personal opinion is sometimes I believe PCA has lost touch with reality when it comes to operating farms and what it takes to do that. To my comment about wanting level heads to prevail and the common sense approach here, I want you to address that concern about the definition of, in your opinion, waters of the state, and what's that going to mean to agriculturists just trying, or farmers just trying to do what it is they do, growing food for the world.
Mr. Kudelka.
Chairman and committee members, thank you for the questions. Let me start with the issue on the puddles and that. We've testified before puddles are not covered under this permit and do not anticipate to be ever covered under the permit. I understand the need for common sense and working on these to remove the regulatory burdens on folks who are trying to work with them. We've been working very closely with the Department of Agriculture. As I mentioned, this is something new to us since previously all pesticide issues were covered by the Department of Agriculture. And we have been making some changes because of comments we received during the public comment period on the public permits. For instance, one of the permits that were drafted was the draft forest canopy pest control permit. There was a threshold of 640 acres where before someone would have to apply for the notice, notification and the application. After listening to the folks, we did increase that tenfold to 6,400. So there has been a work with them on that. Specifically on the water issue, we also adjusted our thresholds in the vegetative pest and algae permit to be consistent with the FIFRA practices, and also designating that only acres that have standing or visible water at the time of the application is needed. Because we do understand there are wetlands at times that are dry, and we aren't looking for a situation to create a producer, an applicator, or even a community that's spraying to put them in gotcha situations where there are times where wetland is dry or a ditch. And the issue of waters of the state, it is our charge from the legislature and state law to regulate water protection efforts through waters of the state. As mentioned by the Department of Agriculture, there are other states that are doing this. North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Illinois are all drafting their permits to waters of the state. Again, our permit is on hold right now. The courts did give EPA an extension to October 31st to deal with the permits. As a result, we have stopped our move on that. There was a deadline of early April. If Congress and the President decide that they need to, if they decide that which should be go back to the Department of Agriculture, or these permits will go away too for the PCA. This is something we are doing in direct response to the court and to EPA. This is not something we were doing on our own.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, could you give us an example of something that would be a waters of the state, but not a public water? What's the difference? Give me an example.
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the definition of waters of the state is Minnesota Statute 115.01, Subdivision 22, and it does mean all streams, lakes, ponds, marshes, watercourses, waterways, wells, springs, reservoir, aquifers, irrigation systems, drainage systems, and all bodies of water accumulating water, surface or underwater. And so that's those are some additional waters there. For instance, certain types of drainage systems and irrigation systems are covered under the definition of public water, I believe, and there are some that are not. That would be one difference.
I don't know, Representative Anderson, how are you going to farm? You figure this out over the break, and you tell me how we're going to farm. But anyway,
yeah, this is an important issue for farmers. Very important issue.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Anderson? Or?
No, not at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kudelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, again, these permits are when these pesticides are sprayed directly to it. It's still the Department of Agriculture's designation when farm or a chemical pesticides are sprayed. Those have to follow the rules under the pesticide, and here for so that if we're not covering those type of situations, it's those very narrow definitions when we're dealing with mosquito and other pest insect control, forest canopy, aquatic nuisance animal, vegetative pests and algae. We're not dealing with such chemicals as Roundup or that, and if they were to be sprayed in the area over these waters, which at that point the Department of Agriculture would have their jurisdiction.
Well, Mr. Gadelka, I'm trying to sort this out in my mind how this gets regulated. I think Mr. Kleben brought up a good point: how many more staff we're going to hire, and what the fiscal impact of the state is. And you could do some thinking about that over the break. We would like to know that, because, as you know, I've been concerned about the fiscal notes. You and I visited about that before, and so. You know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, as they say. So if we have something we like, we don't like fiscal notes, I don't come against them. When we have something, you have something you like, quid pro quo. So that's a question we've got. But I'm trying to sort this through. And let's say we get a 2 or 3 inch rain, and it's time to spray soybean aphids, and Representative Anderson's ready to go, and those aphids are doubling in population every 2 to 3 days, and we got a real serious situation here, and we've got 5 acres on our farm. It's drowned out right now. It's got water in it, and so what do we do here? And we're going to spray one of the products to kill aphids, and it's time is of the essence. We can't wait for the water to disappear. What would we do under this scenario?
Committee members and chairs and committee members, I will need to get back to you specifically on that. I will run that by our staff, and after the break have an answer for you on that issue. On the cost issue, we believe what really drives the number of folks having to apply for the application is not the definition of the waters, but the thresholds we're setting, which is why we're increasing, for instance, in the forest canopy, moving it from the number of acres from 640 10 times to 6,400. And those mechanisms are what are really driving folks having to file the notice of intent in an application.
Yeah, I think Mr. Bezicki wants to help me with my question here. We like you guys. Mr. Kadelka, you worked in the House. We remember that. We like you. You had some sense over there. We just don't want to see you lose your sense here. And you know, Representative Anderson and I are farmers. We like to get along with our neighbors. We don't want to have them come over and have you hire some people to come out and get after us. We all, you know, we're community-minded people. We don't like to see you get in any trouble, and we don't want to have you enact laws here that would get us all in trouble. So, Mr. Bezicki.
Mr. Chair, just perhaps for clarification, and this does get confusing, but just as a basic, I would remind the committee, and to your question, that regardless of this permit system that PCA is obligated to put into practice, FIFRA, the Federal Pesticide Control Law and the Minnesota Pesticide Control Law still prevail, and we administer that. We have not given up any authority at the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, to your question, the product that would be applying, if you had 5 acres of water in the field, the driving issue here is what the label says. If the label would say that your product was okay to apply to the soybean field and to water, then that would be okay. If the label said you can apply to the target, which is the soybean field, but this product cannot go into water, then that would not be okay, regardless of what the PCA permit issue is. So that's just to be clear. The Department of Agriculture is not abdicating any responsibility. We still would have our regulatory authority. The permit, this new thing, is something that only deals with those four activities. That's by court law. So those are the four that I read earlier, mosquito and aquatic. And so this really, the permits really apply to treatment of lakes or treatment to control invasive species, perhaps in lakes, or forest canopy like gypsy moth or army worm or something like that. It really doesn't have anything to do with agriculture, although the new language that the committee is considering, the first sentence, reinforces that the Department of Agriculture is the sole agency for dealing with terrestrials. So if for some reason a new permit, say in 5 years, would come about that had to deal with some terrestrial because of some court case, then it would become our responsibility instead of the PCA's. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time, but I thought I'd clarify that before it got too far.
Okay, Mr. Kadelka, you'd have another issue you wanted to visit with us about in the bill?
Mr. Chair and committee members, just one more issue, and I hope to make it much more brief than the last one. I apologize. On page R14, section 17 of the bill dealing with animal carcass disposal is the other provision. Our concerns, again, relate with water quality and the negative impacts that could...
Excuse me, Mr.
Goodell. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's on page R18.
I apologize.
Section 17 of the Senate language. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Kadelka.
Our concern deals with water quality and negative effects of these of a situation with animal burial goes badly. The best way to handle them, I believe, is a partnership through the Board of Animal Health, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency working together. Over the past few years, the three have been working together to improve the systems and how this is handled, and believe that would be the way to keep moving forward to making improvements to the system. Overall, we believe the three provisions I've mentioned, it may be best to remove the bill and have them travel separately as asked by Governor Dayton and requested in the past by Governor Plenty, separating policy from finance provisions in a finance bill. These provisions do not have direct costs associated with them being covered in the spreadsheet, and they do go beyond the scope of agriculture and rural development and would be good to be part of a wider dialogue that includes other areas. And that's all. I conclude my comments.
Mr. Schoenfeld, if you've got a comment. I'm disappointed. I thought we were getting peace in the valley here with the hog producers, with the livestock people, with the Department of Ag, with the Department of Pollution Control. I'm really disappointed, Mr. Kadelka.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm here to bring a little peace in the valley.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, relative to this particular provision, I think what you're seeing here, and I think actually the discussion about the terrestrial applications is kind of relevant to this too, because the real concern here is kind of about, I guess one way to describe it would be agency authority creep. And I know that the discussion, for instance, Mr. Bozicki just said, well, there's this differentiation between agricultural applied pesticides and these aquatic applied pesticides. But then the question comes in, irrigation and drainage ditches being part of the public waters issue and so forth. And so at what point then does somebody decide or some lawyer decide within the department, well, you know, we've got some authority here that even though the law is there, this should change. And I give you a couple of examples of this, and that's why these other two provisions are in this bill. The provision that deals with the concrete wasn't something that was being enforced or by the PCA for years and years and years. And then 3 years ago, we had a barn fire and some other things that came up, and within the last year or so, all of a sudden, they've come in with some new ideas and some new guidance and so forth. I don't think the law had changed any. It was pretty much that they had done their interpretation of it. So there were some laws in the books. Now, relative to the Board of Animal Health provision, that's something similar, too. For years and years and years, we always thought the Board of Animal Health controlled livestock mortalities. But then going back into the statutes, it said specifically that it dealt with diseased livestock mortalities. So PCA, 3 years ago, we had some barn fires. and we had a lot of dead livestock, and then PCA became involved at that point because the local, I think the local county feedlot officer and the Board of Animal Health had asked PCA, you know, what to do about something, and then we had some problems with it. In any case, those are both examples, I think, kind of a creep. We mentioned the NPDS for feedlots before. One of the things that's been testified many times ahead of committees is that PCA started looking at and said, well, the dust from fans in a barn might potentially be a discharge to the waters. And that's the kind of example I'm trying to use here to talk about this. That's why we're looking at some, trying to define this a bit further. Relative to this particular issue, we've worked with the Department of Agriculture on some language, and the Board of Animal Health apologized. And at least peace in the valley between Board of Animal Health, the Department of Agriculture, and the pork producers, and I think the turkey growers as well. I gather not quite the PCA. And we do have some language that we've agreed to that I think that at least the groups that I just mentioned would be in agreement. And I don't know if you have that language. Did you provide that from the department?
Ms. Gauthier?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Greta Gauthier, Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chairman, yes, late Friday we did get everybody together for an in-depth discussion and got some language pulled together. I did email that to your staff this morning, and I do have it that I can, if the committee is going to be coming back later today, perhaps I can. I have also emailed it to Mr. Knopf.
And Mr. Chair, I could just read it because it's two sentences long.
Mr. Chairman, I could read it as well, either way.
Why don't you just read it?
Right.
We will
says,
take some time over the break to look at this.
Notwithstanding any other law, the executive director of the Board of Animal Health is responsible for the regulation and oversight of livestock mortality disposal. The board shall, in cases where its disposal may impact ground or surface water, seek the input of the Pollution Control Agency. Fairly simple.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Hamilton.
So could PCA comment on that language? Is that language that you could support?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if I could get a copy of it, I can bring it back to our folks.
Okay. We'll come back after the break then and have you testify. Or if we get down the road, we may have to have the commissioner designate come in and testify to the committee too. Mr. Kudelka from the Pollution Control. Thank you. Members, I have an oral amendment I'd like to make before we break, just to, and if any other folks have any amendments, I suggest you throw them out now. But I have an oral amendment on page R7. I would suggest that we take $500,000 from the $3.5 million on line 5.29. So that language, that we would change that to $3 million, and I would move that we put that money into page R8, line 7.1, in the Senate language, add $500,000 to that to make that 2.38 million for the Agri Fund. And I'll explain that a little bit. We've got a situation going on here where we have a chance to get some significant economic development going on here in some areas of the state dealing with some biofuels. To do that, we may need some infrastructure improvements to do that. We're designating, in the Senate language, we're designating, if this amendment is successful, $3 million for the Next Generation Energy Board. We would then designate also, if the amendment is successful, $2.38 million for the Agri-Fund. Again, the Agri-Fund is a fund that will work with the chairs and ranking members will work with the Commissioner of Agriculture to distribute. It basically deals with rural infrastructure, if we're successful in with some of this biofuels efforts, there obviously is going to be some real infrastructure needs, and I'd like to see us beef this AgriFund money up. It does not prohibit the statute language that governs the AgriFund also would allow for money to go into the next gen if we need to down the road. I know that we're going to need some money for rural infrastructures, and I wanted to make sure we have adequate monies there. We're in competition with some other states and some other areas, and I want to make sure we have the resources necessary that we can pull off what we're trying to do. And I visited with our folks about it, and some of you on your side, Chairman Hamilton, and so to that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. We're not adopting this section. The motion is simply to make the amendment to change line 5.29 from 3.5 million to 3 million,
yeah,
and transfer that 500,000 to line 7.1. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman? So just so that the House members are clear, again, we're not adopting this section. We're adopting the amendment to this section.
Yeah, we're just amending the Senate position is all we're doing. So any other questions on that? And I can get into more details about the need for the money at this time if you wish. We'll talk to our side about it, and I can talk to your side, too, some more about it. Some of you have talked to. So,
Mr. Chairman, I just simply state I support the motion.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions about the motion? If not, all those in favor of said motion of modifying the Senate position, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Okay, that motion carries. Do we have any other amendments at this time? Anyone in the audience have any amendments they'd like to offer up? Any other comments? We'll take some testimony for a few more minutes, and then we do need to break. So.
Okay.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Farm Bureau. I'll just be very brief. First of all, Chairman and committee members, I think you have a great bill in front of you, and you've done a lot of good work on it. There are a few contrasting positions, and I'd just like to comment on those. On page R6, we do support the funding for the Ag in the Classroom that's in the House language. We think that's a very important program. And we like the concept that you have here of paying off the ethanol producer payment programs on page R7. We think that's a great idea. And probably most importantly is looking at having that base funding for agri in the next biennium, 14 and 15, at about a $10 million level. We think that's real important. Hopefully this year we don't get into a food fight on how that money gets spent. If there are some needs that are identified, maybe those can be grants or one-time funding so that we can have, spend a couple years looking at the best uses of those funds, because it is for the whole agriculture infrastructure. So hopefully we don't tie those up this year into the future. The provisions that were discussed at length here, the R13 provision on burying concrete, the R14 provision on the terrestrial application of pesticides, and the livestock mortality position, or provision. We support all those provisions and putting them in the bill, maybe tweaking some of the language to address some of the concerns. But even though they are policy issues, I don't think they're terribly controversial among farmers. And they're important provisions that we'd like to see in there. So that would be my comments at this time, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Any questions? I do have a question from our fiscal staff and others on page 6. Since Mr. Raddatz brought it up, the Ag in the Classroom funding, $100,000 each year. Where's that funding coming from, Mr.? Maybe Mr. Reinholtz can tell us.
Mr. Chairman,
and is that ongoing? And are we putting this into base? What's going on with this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that would be ongoing base funding.
Okay. And you're suggesting the money comes from?
Mr. Chairman, it comes from the general fund.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions on the bill at this point? If not, I think what we'll do is recess until 1 o'clock. That'll give us time in the Senate to get our session done. Give us time to think through this. If any other folks want to testify, we'll have time to testify then. I anticipate we'd come back in one, meet for about 2 hours. If we finish the bill, fine. The House is then going to meet at 3.
Stuff here.
So,
you should announce it.
Chairman Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the House members, let's go to room 118 and just caucus this quick, if you would, please, right after this meeting. Room 118 in the Capitol.
I think we have the room for the day, so you can leave your materials if you wish and not to take them with you. So, with that, we're going to recess until approximately 1 o'clock. Thank you.